everybody, and welcome to 500 Open Tabs. I'm Kaveh Taharian.
And I'm Hannah Hillam.
Welcome back to the show. We are totally out of our minds today, more than normal. We've delayed the recording of this a couple times because somebody couldn't get it together in time, and that somebody's me, of course.
Oh, I was going to say my son for throwing up everywhere. Yeah. Get it together, kid.
Did you catch any of his vomit yesterday? No, today.
Oh, that's right. You delayed it today. That's right. Were you throwing up? I'm just kidding.
No, I didn't catch any vomit.
I did catch vomit, but not with my hands. Anyway, no one wants to hear about this.
I think there's some people who do, but yes, I know the important primer for this conversation is that you got thrown up not once, not twice, but thrice yesterday.
Thrice on me. There's just kid puke. And like I was telling you earlier, like it gets to the point where you're like no longer in your body and you're like, oh, yes. Oh, the throw up hits that body right there. The one that I used to call mine.
It's very impressive and admirable. And I salute you for getting thrown up on because that's not
Thank
fun.
Thank you. Thank you.
Speaking of getting thrown up on, we have a couple of fun tabs for you this week.
Yeah, you guys ready to get some vomit on you?
Word vomit, yeah.
Verbal vomit.
How's that for a transition? That worked out pretty well.
That was really beautiful. Yeah.
Thank you.
Are you going to puke first or am I?
I think I'm going to puke first this week.
Oh, okay. Awesome.
Yes, I believe that this week I'm going to go first. And considering that this is a little bit long, I should go as soon as possible and not waste time with any kind of pleasantries.
Go. Okay.
So my tab is an article from Harper's by Nat Segnit. Apologies if the name's pronounced incorrectly. And the title of the article is Who Killed Louis Le Prince on the Forgotten Father of Film?
Oh, interesting. Okay.
Do you know anything about this person?
Not a single thing.
I did not know either, which seems to be a common thread amongst people.
Yeah.
So I had started with this tab, but this man's story opened up a whole other chapter that I was not familiar with. And to be clear, the title is very like, you know, true crimey, and it's about like, you know, who done it, like all this stuff.
Yeah.
And that's sort of been done a little bit. And I'm not super... Yeah. Not just true crime as a genre, but like for him, like there's stuff you can go look into about like what the motives were and who might have been the person that killed him.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Or if he was even killed or if he just died. There's all these different theories. I'll cover some of them at the end of it.
Okay. I'm excited.
But I'm not super interested in how he died because I think what's more interesting is like he seems like a good dude. Who had like a lot of interesting ideas that manifested in ways that affected all of our lives in a really positive and beautiful way. So I wanted to really focus on that and kind of his story about how he came to be this person that made this discovery rather than being like, and then his body was discovered and dismembered, which is like, I'm not into that part of it.
See, I am, but like, that's so basic to be into right now. You know what I mean? So it's like, I'm really into that, but everyone's into that. So I can't be into that anymore.
Well, I just mean that exists. That you can, he doesn't get dismembered. Spoiler alert. But you can look into that. I just was like, I don't really have much to contribute in terms of that. But
this is good. This is good because this is like what I love about what I want to see more of in true crime is like hearing about the victims rather than about how they died. So this is awesome.
Yeah. And also, I'll just say this up front. This is not going to be like a two-parter in the way that like the Johnstown episode was. This is not like a building up for like another thing, but the story is it sets the stage for like another story, which is kind of interesting to me and insane that like I didn't know about. So just up front, like this is going to be I will have another part of this next week, but this specific story I thought was cool because it sets the stage for a lot of crazy stuff that happens.
Cool.
So that's where I'm gonna start off. So our story begins with Louis Le Prince, who it's going to be awkward for me to have to pronounce his name correctly in French as I speak
just
in English throughout this.
Louis the Prince.
Louis the Prince. Louis the Prince was born to a military family in France in 1841. And his father was a major of artillery in the French army who received a Legion of Honor.
Oh.
Fancy Vance. And as a young man, the talented Le Prince Le Prince, would also study art in Paris and chemistry in Leipzig, Germany.
Oh, so jack of all he's trades. A bit of,
yeah, but not just jack of all trades, but he's equal parts science and he's equal parts art.
Cool.
He's left and right brained, which is kind of cool. These varying fields of study would play all a part in the future of this inventor's work. And he moved around from France to Leeds for a bit up in England. And that's where he met and married his wife, Lizzie Whitley. And together they, you know, knock out a few kids and they even start a school of applied
art.
I that like are vomiting that. Everywhere, I'm sure. They're just catching vomit left and right.
Oh, so much puke. I just like knocking out. That's a good word for that.
It's knocked it out. You know, it's different times. You can just you can knock kids out real quick back then.
Yeah, you could.
But together, this husband and wife team, they found the Leeds Technical School of Art, which I don't know about what you do with your husband, but I certainly didn't start a school with my wife, which that's cool as hell.
Me neither. We just watch reels together and laugh until we fall asleep.
As long as you're laughing together, that's important.
It's not all we do, but that's what we've been doing lately.
That's a good part of marriage. Anyway, so they start a school, and it's awesome. It's in Leeds. They're doing well. They got a few kids. They're having a good time. And eventually, they make it out to New York City. And I guess they're sort of like, hey, let's go see what this America thing is all about that people have been talking about.
Everyone's going.
Everyone's going. Let's go check it out. And Le Prince becomes a manager for an artist group that specialized in panoramas that were exhibited throughout the country.
Oh, cool.
So basically, they're like these landscape murals. And they're these really big paintings, and they feel really immersive when you're standing in front of them. He managed these artists that were making these murals, and they were big, and they were immersive. And he kind of was like, this is an interesting thing, and he was sort of fascinated by it for reasons that will come clear, that will come back later. And by the late 1870s, early 1880s, people have seen what the still camera can do, and ideas are starting to float around in the ether for moving pictures. So, you know, remember, the still camera is invented in 1816. So it's taking still photographs. It's not yet, the motion picture camera had not yet been invented.
1816?
Is when the film camera got invented. Yeah, I think that's when the marker of
it is. Oh, I had no
idea.
Crazy. Okay.
Yeah, so it's a few decades later, and you know, people are getting better at it, and there's all this technology that's developing, and so around the time that Le Prince is living in New York, and also, to be clear, he grew up with like this love of photography, and he was sort of fascinated by it, and he you know, this is a guy who works with his hands, and he understands tech, and he understands art and beauty and all these things, so it was like a natural progression for him, and you know, like a lot of stuff that was happening at that time, these ideas are sort of up in the air, and people are sort of like, one guy's got one idea and another person's got another. Oh, you know, I wonder if this can be part of it. And it's all sort of swirling together. Edward Muybridge had done his whole tripwire horse racing camera thing.
Oh, yeah.
Which was really cool. Do you know about this?
Yes.
Yeah. So just a primer for people who don't know. It's like the first. So everyone's trying to figure out how to capture motion at this time. And what Muybridge does is he has these like tripwires set up as this horse is running across a track. And then there's like a succession of cameras. So like as it goes through, it's like, oh, here's one picture, here's one picture, here's one picture, here's one picture. And then he's stringing them all together so you can sort of get a sense of motion. And it ends up being...
Yeah, you can like watch it. You can watch like a version of it. You can just go look it up on YouTube, I'm sure.
Yeah, there's the... I forget what the spinny thing is called that you rope into it. And it like sort of recreates it. But... there's that. Etienne Jules Marie perfected the revolving gun camera, which took up to 12 pictures a second and is literally as insane as you are probably imagining it in your mind.
Yeah, a gun?
I'm sending you a picture of it.
Okay.
I do not understand how this thing came to be, but it literally looks like a Looney Tunes gun.
Let's see. That's like a camera gun. That's just a camera gun.
It's a shotgun, but like the old Tommy guns that had like the round on the bottom before the bullets. This is like
but
on top.
Instead of like a magazine, it's like it's film.
Yeah, it's really, I do not, it's weird. I was starting to go down.
I'm yeah, just ahead. Like, okay, look at the camera and smile. And it's just pointed straight at your face. Because that's what it would be. Which if someone has one of these, I want to try it. Please.
And immediately get arrested.
Immediately. immediately. We're in America. No, I wouldn't get arrested in America. Never
Actually,
mind.
That's not true. They'd probably elect you to Congress. They'd be like, she just wants to shoot her camera gun.
Hannah.
Yeah, exactly. Depending on where you live, you could do it.
Yeah.
That thing is awesome. It's taking a bunch of pictures a second. And George Eastman's paper roll film became available, and this was followed by, I'm sorry, in 1885, George Eastman's paper roll film became available and was followed by the commercial development of celluloid film in late 1889. So, okay. You know, you got cameras that are taking pictures faster. There's, you know, paper roll film, which is a crucial part of it. It's not just one picture. It's a whole roll, and then it becomes celluloid, which makes it a little bit more durable. And, you know, ideas are building on ideas and are building on ideas. So there's like all this traction. And the stage is set. And our boy, Le Prince, right? He's hype. He's loved all this kind of stuff, like I said, since he was a kid. And he's got the sense that the world is on the precipice of something incredible. The interesting thing here to me is, right, and this is sort of the crux of why this man is interesting to me.
Okay.
It's not like you invent the camera. It's not like you invent the motion picture camera and then people were like, cool, we've invented a motion picture camera. It's time to invent movies and tell long form narratives that involve editing and orchestral scores and all this. It's like, that's not even like a glimmer in anyone's eye. They're all trying to solve like a technical problem. These are all technicians. They're all like, well, how do I get this to go faster? How do I get this to be like, they didn't have any idea what cinema would or even could be. But Le Prince, he was different. He saw it. He saw it for what it could be.
Because he's an artist too.
Because he's an artist and he has the brain of an engineer. Motion pictures, he predicted to his wife, that's what he started calling them, he said, quote, it would abolish the divine right of kings and much needless priestcraft.
Oh my, I love that.
Right?
That's hardcore.
He's not messing around. And
I mean, he's French.
To him, it's,
and at that point, the French were like, kill all kings.
Smoking a cigarette is just like, this is getting away as the divine rights of king. I don't know what voice I'm doing.
Get rid of
here,
all
but...
king. That was a pretty good French accent.
Yeah. And much needless priestcraft.
Your Nixon is better, but that was good too.
French Nixon being like, the divine rights of kings and much needless priestcraft.
I feel like French Nixon, the idea of a French Nixon would like tear the space time. Like it would just tear a hole.
Oui, ça c'est what I get. I don't know what I'm doing.
Embrace it. How do you say Watergate in French?
Le gate de l'eau. I don't know gate. I forget what the gate word is. Gate. Anyway, moving on.
Yep.
He sees this as like a higher calling. It's more than a problem to be solved. This is a door to be opened.
Yeah.
And he keeps tinkering away because he believes in it. And he comes up with a couple of ideas, one of which is this insane 16 lens camera that I don't even understand how that's supposed to work. But I think... it's kind of meant to be here. I'll send you a picture of it as well. We'll have this up on the screen.
I just pictured an iPhone with 16 lenses.
It sort of just looks like a box that has like chicken pox on it or something.
A box with chicken pox?
I don't know. That's just where
my mind
went.
It does. It looks like a mouse trap, like a line of mouse traps surrounding a bunch of holes.
I think the thinking might have been something similar to Muybridge, but just all in one thing instead of like a trip or
so.
It's like, oh, we'll kind of do this all at once, but it's not quite there.
No.
He's tinkering away though. He's trying to solve the problem. He's trying to use it, and most importantly, he has an idea of what it's supposed to be used for. And he patents this idea. He patents the 16 lens camera. And at that time, that was a big deal because that's when the so-called patent wars start to become a thing. Patents are now a thing that enter the public consciousness and people are making money off of it. And they're realizing like, oh, if I file a patent, everybody's going to have to pay me for this thing. So that's in large part what drives a lot of these inventors at the time. Because a lot of stuff hadn't been invented or patented yet. So they're like, great, let's just do this. What if we invent a rock that has a face on it? I don't know.
They can throw itself through a window.
Perfect. Patented. You know, he's living his life. He's managing these painters. He's trying to come up with this camera thing on the side. And then in 1887, unfortunately, Le Prince's mother passes away. And she leaves her 5-story townhouse in Paris to him and his elder brother, Albert.
Dope.
Now, Louis, that's his first name, by the way. I think I glossed over this very quickly. But Louis, Louis doesn't need a house, but he does need money to keep toiling away at his motion picture camera idea. So he agrees to sell his share to his brother for 60,000 francs, which is now worth roughly $700,000 today.
Oh, wow.
It's a lot of money.
I could buy a condo.
I was going to say, you could buy you can buy like a house that just recently caught fire that's a one-bedroom toilet in San Francisco and then have enough for that's enough for your down payment and then you have to pay more for a mere $10,000 a month you can pay off for another 50 years. Anyway, so...
Sounds good to me.
He kind of comes in to money, not quite yet, but the promise of money. And he's also offered something from his father-in-law. And his father-in-law says, hey, if you want to come back to Leeds and use my foundry and resources to like work on your weird camera thing, that's cool with me too. Uh-huh. And he's like, okay, there's some money coming in from here. The father-in-law's over here giving me this place. Let's just do this. So he decides to leave behind Lizzie, his wife, and the children. They would stay in New York and they would, because they're, remember, they're running this business together. The wife's already doing it. So he decides, I got to go to Europe. I got to go sort of resolve this, spend a little bit of time and a little bit of money to try and figure this out. And then I'll come back. With his father-in-law's backing and the promise of financial security, he goes to Leeds and it becomes his full-time gig to work on this motion picture camera. This is the dream. This is what we're all... I mean, the dream is not that your mother dies, but the dream is that like somehow you'll come into a bunch of money and be able to focus.
Can I say something about Leeds?
Of course. Yes, go ahead.
So I've done a ton of research into Leeds in the 1880s, actually, because...
I assumed you would have.
That's where my family's from. The Hillams Yeah, the Hillams come from Leeds and Bradford. Yeah, yeah. So I got really into figuring out why they left, and it was all just because the industry there was popping. It was crazy. Like, if you had a good idea, or if you had money, you were set. And if you didn't, you had to move to America. My family were weavers. They would weave like rugs and stuff like that. And then the Industrial Revolution happened and they were like, sorry, we have machines now. And so they like had to move into this tiny little cramped apartment in Leeds until they were pretty much like technology pushed them out of the business and they left. And so Leeds was crazy at this point. It was like in the like Silicon Valley level, like excitement in the air.
There's a lot of parallels to this kind of stuff in here, like what you're talking about. And actually, I'll address specifically what we just talked about in a second. So he was obsessed. So you're right. Le Prince is he's obsessed with this idea of what they call persistence of vision, which is tricking the eye into perceiving successive still images as continuous movement.
Mm.
Right? Remember, he's thinking about it in a very different way than the technicians and the other people who are trying to build cameras are.
Right.
This made him different from Muybridge, Mary and others, not to capture a fleeting moment in order to examine it more closely, but to stitch it together seamlessly. The idea is not to stop time, but to simulate its flow, right? These are tiny sort of swing things that are slightly different, but it makes, you know, a huge difference in actually how you perceive it. And he eventually had a breakthrough when he realized that in order to achieve that effect, the film didn't need to continuously pass through the camera projector. So if you think about two toilet paper rolls, right? One's on top, one's on bottom. It would just go like, psh. That's how they were thinking about it, was that the camera needs to just have the film
go through it continuously
because they're thinking, well, it's motion. It needs to move. How do we do this? Blah, blah, blah. They're thinking like, how do we sort of make it go smoothly? He realizes, and this is kind of an interesting thing to me. This is speculation. There's an author who wrote a whole book about this. This is sort of speculation. There's no proof that this is exactly like the inspiration for it, but he sort of posits this idea that like it might have had to do something with him living in Leeds at the time, like having gone back to it.
Mm-hmm.
Because Leeds was the center of the textile industry in the late 19th century, specializing in cropping and the dyeing of broadcloth.
So that's what we were involved in.
Exactly. Yeah. That's so cool.
So
literally, this is a little excerpt, and it says, walking through the neighborhood or even along its edges, as Le Prince did hundreds of times, he would have heard the clanking and punching of dozens and dozens and dozens of sewing machines, the steady chunka-chunka-chunka-chunka of needles punching through fabric, the machine's mechanisms intermittently moving the cloth forward, stopping it for each stitch, driving it forward for the next.
Whoa. I like that. So, I have a parallel to this. This is really cool.
It's crazy. Yeah.
Whoa.
Also,
okay.
It's the power of, you know, when you're spending a lot of time in that creative space and you're sort of open to ways that solutions can happen that you won't necessarily logically think of.
Right. You know, but it's just like you feel it.
He's feeling the chuk 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 chuk, right? And it's going like one by one. And then so he sort of is like, huh, I wonder if the film doesn't have to go through continuously in a roll, if it just stops for just long enough in the same way that like a sewing machine works.
Oh.
Again, that's a theory. That's not like on the record of him having said that. But like,
I'm deciding it's true.
I also feel like in my heart it's true.
As an artist.
I feel like that feels right to me. That feels like that is the kind of thing that you would have a realization about. And just because he didn't go write it in his diary doesn't mean that that's not 100% correct fact that we're determining right now.
This show isn't about
facts.
Actually, it is about, it is. It should
or
be
logic.
About facts.
But it should be, but it's not.
It should be, but it's not. I feel that's what it was, and I like the idea of that. So,
yeah.
Go on.
And that becomes, but that's the crux of it. That's what becomes what makes his motion picture camera different from everybody else's and work correctly. And he goes and he like, whatever, works on stuff. He has assistants, he's doing stuff. And then on the morning of October 14th, 1888, Louis Le Prince set up a heavy wooden box in his father-in-law's home garden on the outskirts of Leeds. And he started turning the brass crank and he filmed the world's first motion picture, which was
the first.
This is the first. And it's a 2-second snippet known as Ronde Garden Scene. I don't know if that's Ronde or Ronde. I don't know. I've never seen that name before. So,
Ronde.
I'm assuming it's like one word, but it seems French. So it's probably Ronde Garden Scene,
Ronde,
something like
yeah.
that. So in this two-second snippet, there's four people. It's his in-laws, Joseph and Sarah Whitley, who are, you know, elderly people, and his 16-year-old son, Adolf, who was visiting from New York, and a family friend, Annie Hartley. And they're sort of milling about the lawn by a bay window. And from a personal perspective, it was kind of interesting. And it was very timely because, this is an important fact to remember, his mother-in-law, Sarah Whitley, was to die 10 days later after the footage was shot.
Oh.
So it's sort of this weird, like, beautiful miracle that,
yeah.
A, he films this first thing, and it's also, like, the first thing that's ever existed as far as motion pictures are concerned. He manages to film and immortalize his mother-in-law.
That's really sweet. Like,
it is.
I have a little theory that, like, why we're so attached to photography is because we're terrified of losing people and never seeing them again, obviously.
Yeah.
That's why we like being able to represent things in that way. And so it's like that the very first time someone does it with motion picture, it also, like, was a personal connection for him. And that makes it really meaningful. I like that.
Yeah. And me too. I had the same essence. I thought it was... So in essence, it's basically like the first thing that's ever been filmed was a home movie. And it was just this little thing to immortalize a loved one.
By the way, I think Round Hay is just in English. My hunch was correct. Round Hay is a neighborhood within Leeds.
Oh, it was a neighborhood within Leeds. Okay, it's not French.
I got excited to see the film, so I was looking at a picture of it.
Oh, I should have shown you. I didn't even think to see. I told you I was frazzled. Did you find it? Did you find the film?
Yeah. Whoa. Okay.
What Continue. Strikes you about it as you're watching it?
It's like almost, it's what's the word? When something's a casual, you're not posed.
It's authentic.
Candid. Candid. It looks really candid. Like, these people are just kind of like milling around, just doing their thing. Yeah, it just looks like a little home movie.
That's exactly right. That's what I was saying. So in essence, like, the first thing that's ever recorded is this home movie, and it was filmed just in time to immortalize a loved one.
I
feel like that's really beautiful. I think that's like a really meaningful contribution to this device and the medium and all that stuff.
It's very human.
And it's very human. And his motion picture camera was clearly a success. Of course, from here, he had more plans. Le Prince had plans to film fictional movies, to build a screening room he called a people's theater, quote unquote, and to establish motion pictures as a means both to educate and, quote, connect the people of the world.
He's way ahead of his time.
Remember the panoramic paintings?
Yeah.
That's the inspiration arguably for theaters for him. So he's like, he's looking at these big panoramic paintings. He's like, it's really cool when you look at an image that's very big and sort of envelops you and like makes you feel like you're in some place. And so that idea kind of, you know, debatably ends up sort of that plants a seed that pays off later, where he's just like, and there are sketches of this where he's like, okay, like if we have like a screen that's big here, then there's these like little benches around it. So like he sort of even comes up with the idea of a movie theater, and that like film should be projected large. And it's meant to be this immersive experience that you experience with other people. Like it's supposed to be a collective. Right. In my opinion, this guy is a visionary in that sense. It's not just that he's solving a technical problem. He has an idea for what the purpose of it is and how it should be displayed and what it's emotionally meant to do for, you know, all of us.
Well, because when you think about it, it's like, why are movies massive? Why do we all, I mean, I always thought it was like the tradition of theater, like live theater. They just replaced the stage with a big screen. But this makes sense too. Like this, I mean, it was probably a lot of reasons, but this is really cool.
And meanwhile, across the pond, that same month in October, 1888, famed American inventor and gigantic dickhead Thomas Edison.
Oh,
you already know
where
this story is going.
Oh, yeah. Screws over Tesla. Yeah.
Filed a preliminary claim known as a caveat with the U.S. Patent Office, announcing his plans to create a device that would do, quote, for the eye what the phonograph does for the ear.
Wait. Okay.
This is something I'd never heard of. So if you've never heard of a caveat, it's a good thing because they no longer exist, but it was definitely a thing at one point and they were stupid.
Noted.
Basically, a caveat would, you could be like, hey, I got this idea for like, whatever, like a flying car or something. And then you could file a caveat and send it to the patent office without any accompanying schematics or explanation. And the patent office would just be like, okay, cool. We'll go ahead and file this away for you. And you figure it out. All you got to do is pay an annual fee of $10 to make sure that your balance was current.
So it's like pretty much like licking the cookie that you want and being like, it's mine now, don't touch it.
The cookie doesn't even exist. that's the crazy part.
So it's an idea. You're getting like a pre-patent for an idea.
For a pre-patent an idea, and you pay your $10 every year, and then that thing's a placeholder. Now, where it gets truly stupid is, so let's say, for example, 5 years later, you screw off and you go off, you're doing whatever. You're like, I don't know, you're eating pizzas every day or something for 5 years. You don't do any of the work. 5 years later, someone else has an idea for, in this case, let's say a flying car, and they file their own patent for it, or, you know, they file their preliminary claim, the caveat.
Yeah.
The patent office gets that thing and they come in and they're like, I wonder if somebody else had done this as well. So they look and they say, oh yeah, 5 years ago, Thomas Edison, homeboy over here, had filed a patent for a flying car. And they'll just basically call up Edison and be like, hey dude, remember that patent you had from 5 years ago at this flying car? This other jabroni wants to file the patent, but like you got first dibs and you've been paying $10 a month. So
and that's what Edison
got 3 months.
Use out his pizza and goes, what? Because he's been eating pizza for 5 years. Yeah.
That's all he does. They're like, you've got 3 months. You have 3 months to deliver the goods. They're not like, you need to send this by EOD, this alleged patent that you've been working on. They're just like, yeah, in 3 months, if you could deliver the goods, it's yours. And we'll retroactively date it to 5 years ago when you first filed the whatever.
Okay, that's super unfair.
And Edison was like, great, I'll get my finest inventors to take it on and take all of the credit. This basically was a large part of how Edison worked. Like, that's basically what he did.
Yeah.
So he would just come up with like random ideas. And to be clear, like I haven't done a deep dive on Edison. I'm not going to go into like all the specific ones. But from what I can tell, a large part of what he would do would just be he would have like a rough idea for something. And then he was able to file the patent for it retroactively. And then in the meantime, would be working on something else until it wasn't like super pressing when somebody else would try and challenge him. And then he'd put his dude on it that he had already paid. And they would maybe hopefully be able to figure it out and file a patent and then go into court and argue with people and all this kind of stuff.
Wow.
And then be like, cool, I won the court case. I basically invented this thing like 5 years before everybody else, even though I literally didn't start it until like 3 months ago.
Wow, that makes sense because he was always in court and he was always...
Always like, in court.
Constantly screwing people over and like, who was it, the guy who made the radio? No, I don't, you know, I'm talking... That Italian guy who's like, did something and then Edison got the patent for it. Just a bunch of that kind of stuff.
A few times, yeah.
There's more than once he does this.
Yeah.
The American way.
The American way, which, to be fair, as I was saying earlier, you know, Le Prince is not working in a vacuum. It's like everybody is sort of bouncing off each other. People are like, Muybridge is inspiring people. I think Muybridge at one point even goes to Jersey to show his, because, you know, he's in Menlo, Edison's in Menlo Park in New Jersey. I think that's part of what the impetus was for him. So people are getting inspired. It's not like one person had this idea and then they owned it. Everybody else is sort of working towards a similar goal.
It's in the zeitgeist. It's like in the collective consciousness. Yeah,
exactly. So, but of course, Edison, he files this caveat. He's not going to do it. So he hires a guy named William Kennedy Dixon to figure it out for him. And they come up with the idea of the kinetograph to film stuff, which is like, that would be the his fancy version of his camera, and the kinetoscope to view it. And the kinetoscope to me is really interesting because this is just my own sort of, no pun intended, projection on this.
Nice.
But it's such like a pathology of like who Edison was versus like who Le Prince was and like how they saw where this device was going to go. Because Le Prince saw this as like, it's this communal thing. It's big. It's beautiful. We're going to sit there and experience these moments together on like a giant screen. And it's about connection. And Edison patents this thing that he's like, ah, screw that. We'll just have, you know, this big, like little box that has like a tiny hole that you can put your eyeball in and you could look at your stupid little TikTok video for like 13 seconds at a time and then move out of line so somebody else can come pay me to use it.
He's gotten his wish. That's what our world is right now.
It all came back to it anyway.
Oh.
So he's not interested. He's not thinking about it as this unifier. He's thinking about it like, how do I like exploit this as much as possible?
That really does show his personality. That's how he sees the world. He sees the world as an individual. Like people are individuals out for themselves. Anyway, yeah.
And so over the next 2 years, Le Prince made improvements to his machines and until September 1890. And after visiting his recently widowed brother in Dijon in France, he planned to return via Paris and Liverpool to New York, where he would have a coming out party for his motion picture camera and the idea of cinema. Martin Scorsese would have loved it.
Immediately was like, he's gay? Oh, he's coming out? And then I remember that it's 1890 and no, he's not. So
he's definitely not
Martin Scorsese? I steamrolled over what you said.
No, no, he just said, I was just saying that he would have debuted the motion picture camera and the idea for cinema with like a capital C. And Scorsese would have been like, that's cinema.
Got it.
However, tragically, he would never make it.
No!
Somewhere en route, he went missing, and so did his chances of being recognized as the pioneer that he was.
What? This is when he goes missing?
That's when he goes missing.
I hate this story.
In like October 1890,
or what? Oh, you're going to tell me. Okay,
So this is where the questions arise.
Yeah.
So in October 1890, a little less than a month after he was last seen alive, a body that vaguely fit Le Prince's description turned up at the Paris morgue. The cause of death was drowning, although the face showed signs of trauma consistent with a beating. But people are not entirely on board with this because there's no mention of his height. Le Prince was 6'3". He was huge. He was very tall.
That's super tall.
Particularly at that time when the average male was 5'6". So there's no way that a 6'3" gigantic dude with a beaten face, they wouldn't just be like, look at this giant ass
tall
dude
man.
Who's 6'3" who drowned. Yeah. They're just like, I don't know. This guy got beat up.
Yeah.
So they would have noted kind of his like, height. They would have absolutely noted it is what the theory is. So I'm going to go over a couple of the theories. But again, remember, this is not meant to be about the conspiracies here.
Yeah.
To me, this is a man who, by all accounts, was a good dude who had this passion for this thing. And he pursued it with the zeal of being able to give something back. And that's the important part of this story. But again, just for a little bit of red meat for everybody in terms of true crime stuff, there's a couple of theories. One is his brother may have killed him for the money. He was also bad at money and hadn't bought out the rest of the house. He hadn't given him the 700 grand that he said he was going to give him. Additionally,
one of us. Sorry, bad at money. One of me.
Right. One of us. I'm saying one of us. Yeah. And he was also the one that was like, yeah, I saw him at the train station when he was about to leave. And he was technically the last person to have seen him before he disappeared. Again, there's no evidence for this, but that seems like to be a somewhat motivating factor. We're like, that could be a good reason. Le Prince's great-granddaughter, Lori Snyder, because they've stayed famous and sort of people keep keeping tabs on his descendants. She said, quote, my personal theory is pretty mundane. Since Louis took a later train, the Wilsons, who were his friends who were there to meet him in Paris, went ahead and left for England when Louis didn't disembark when they expected him to. According to Lizzie's memoirs, which was his wife, the train Louis took would have arrived in Paris at about 11 p.m. Being so late, he probably hailed a cab to take him to his workshop. I think the driver, taking advantage of the hour and darkness, took him to a remote location near the Seine, hit him over the head, and threw him in the Seine. There were two articles from this time that suggest... Yeah, just like a victim of a random crime.
Wrong place, wrong time.
There were two articles from this time that suggested that thieves were targeting lone travelers and Le Prince was in the wrong place at the wrong time.
Oh.
That's one theory again.
Yeah.
And, of course, there's the big theory that everybody loves.
Edison.
This is the third and final one. Edison.
That's the first thing I thought of when I found out he went missing.
It's the first one everyone thought
Edison.
Of.
Yeah.
So this one's interesting, and I kind of like it because I like the idea of Edison being a murderer and being a bad person.
Because probably
that's, like, that's satisfying to me.
Yeah.
But in terms of motive, doesn't make a lot of sense. And here's the other thing to me. It gives him too much credit.
Right.
And I'll tell you why. There doesn't seem to be much evidence to suggest that he knew the film camera was going to become the revolutionary tool that was going to inspire all of cinema and become like a billion-dollar business.
Right.
At best, it was going to show quick little like vaudevillian, you know, snippets.
TikToks.
With no edits or anything. And Edison, you know, he's not like this genius visionary who could like imagine an entire industry. He's just coming from like, how do I come up with these weird little things and slap them together and like get a patent on it and then like use that to leverage another thing and make money? Like he's sort of like this, he's a hustler in a way, you know.
Well,
he's not like this, you know, Steve Jobs is this controversial figure that people still talk about, but I'm like, you can't say that Steve Jobs didn't have an idea of like what personal computers were going to be in the future. Like, love him or hate him, like the guy had an idea of what it should be and was sort of like the first one to... that's not what Edison is. That's not how he is. He's not Steve Jobs. He's a squatter buying Walmart.com before Walmart thought to get on the internet and then sold it to them for a huge amount of money.
Did that happen?
The idea that he had... No. I'm just saying like that's... No. But that's... Squatters are a thing on the internet, especially in the early days before big corporations came on. So I don't... It just doesn't add up to me that he would think that and he would be able to think that far ahead and that he would be like, well, I'm going to murder this guy who's competition because I want to invent the camera because I think that motion pictures are going to be the greatest thing. That's I don't buy that he had that kind of vision. I just don't.
And
but,
to like,
you know,
organize that and like, I don't know. It just seems like there would be a lot more involved and something would have come out because he wouldn't have done it himself.
Yeah.
He would have had conspirators and then they would have like told somebody. And anyway, it's never that fun.
Clean cut. Yeah. No. Like I said, I think the most damning thing of it is I don't think it gives him too much. I think it gives him too much credit. I don't think he was that smart in that way.
No, I think you're right.
That he'd be willing
to
go to like murder for it.
He was like laser focused on exploitation and making money and patents and not how can I kill this man in France.
And also don't forget, he's literally doing that like all over the place. He's got however many dozens of other patents that are all like these irons in the fire at the same time.
Right.
So it's not like the camera was any one thing. He's already got like 50 of these. It's just like, I don't know, it could be this one or that one or that. He wouldn't go out of his way to do that. It doesn't make sense. So there's one final note though. I found this thing on sciencedirect.com, which is weirdly insane to me. And I do not understand why this is not a bigger deal. And I might've just missed a bunch of stuff. But I don't understand this, but anyway. And Science Direct seems to be a somewhat reputable place where people have like science articles and stuff. It's not you know, it's not like some conspiracy site. So,
right.
In an article from 2008, Alexis Bedford, a graduate student at the University of New York who was studying chemistry and photography, had been doing research into the history of motion pictures. His search led him to the inner forgotten archives of the New York Library.
Oh.
There he stumbled across a dilapidated leather-bound book which turned out to be one of Edison's notebooks. He was fond of jotting down ideas and test data.
Whoa.
He found a small entry dated September 20th, 1890, by Edison's own hand, which read, quote, "Eric called me today from Dijon. It has been done. Prince is no more. This is good news, but I flinched when he told me murder is not my thing. I'm an inventor, and my inventions for moving images can now move forward," end quote.
Okay. No, no. No way.
So
no.
Bedford takes the journal back to NYU to historian Robert E. Meyer. And this Robert Meyer, after weeks of examining the journal to ascertain its authenticity, which included penmanship comparison with known Edison articles and a computed tomography scan, basically like computery nerd stuff.
Yeah.
Meyer agreed that the journal was indeed authentic and that the note dated September of 1890 was genuinely Edison's own.
Huh? Wait.
And the
murder is not my thing. It sounds like a real, like a modern day. That's not my thing. It's just not my thing. What?
And then, so in this article is like, oh, isn't that interesting? Thanks. That's it. That's the end of the article.
What?
And like, there's no, and I'm like, what?
There's nothing else. Is it that you're going to leave me with that? That's it.
That's what I was left with. Now you're infected by it.
Oh no. I don't think that can't be true. Oh no. What have you done? I'm going to go open like 6 tabs.
Yeah.
Not right now. I have to stop myself.
Not right now.
Just
kind
of, yes. Okay.
So
that is,
I don't know. There doesn't seem to be like there doesn't seem to be a bunch of stuff that was, you know, came up about it. Admittedly, I didn't go like super far into that because I had to finish for this.
Yeah.
But to be continued on that part of it. But
ooh.
That's crazy. Although, of course, that's still not evidence that he did it. That's just a very suspicious journal entry, which seems to be confirmed that was written by him. Coincidence?
Because, yeah. You know, I could see like, okay, let's say that is accurate and that's real. And I'm sure we don't have time to talk about this right now, but I'm going to anyway. If he did have something to do with it, I could easily see it being like, hey, can you like stop him somehow? Like, but
like
through the pipeline, it's like, oh, I'll just kill him. Like, or they try
That's
to stop him
idea.
Or it gets out of control. Because a lot of times that happens, like that time one of the kings of England was like complaining about one of his archbishops and one of his like knights was like, I'll go kill him. And the king was like, no.
No.
Why'd you do that? So like something like that, I could easily see something happening like that. Anyway.
That's a very reasonable assessment. Yeah, I think that makes sense.
Murder's not my thing.
Anyway, but the motion picture camera's story does not end here, and it will get even wackier on my tab next week.
What?
So that's where I'm going to end it.
You're really good at cliffhangers.
I'm like, whoa. Tune back in next week for our next episode about the motion picture camera, where we talk about how it filmed moving pictures.
You said so much and you did not say anything.
Exactly. I have a whole podcast where I do this. Anyway.
Oh my gosh.
The
what is it?
Important thing
Should
to
I
remember.
To it?
500 open tabs. The important thing to remember here is Le Prince was he was a prince among men. He's a cool dude. He's a family
visionary.
Man. Visionary. He started an art school, he managed artists in New York. He was inspired by panoramic paintings that were immersive and beautiful. He had an idea for what cinema at its best would be. And he should be given credit as being the visionary that he is and not the dude that may or may not have been murdered by like lazy-ass
Edison
who couldn't even bother. Like who did a shitty job at it.
What a bummer. Like what a loss. It's times like that where I'm like, if he hadn't have died so young, what could we have had? Or like what would cinema be like now? Would there be a more artistic human aspect to it rather than just like, I don't know. You know what I mean? I'm sure you've been thinking about this. Like what?
That's sort of the central question of where I'm going to go next time.
Oh my gosh. Okay. I won't say anything else.
Yeah. I'm glad that's where your mind went. Cause that's sort of what I'm not going to tease it. Cause I'm like, it just sort of gets weird. And I'm like, oh, I didn't know any of this stuff.
Cool,
but it's cool anyway. So that's my tab. I think he's a cool dude. I think we should remember that name, Le Prince. He's an important fellow, and he he was a real artist and he really believed in the idea of making movies. And there is this aspect of it right now that, you know, Hollywood, frankly, is sort of falling apart right now. And with these, it's been a really rough couple of years. So there is this element of it where I'm like, why are we doing this? Like, what was the point of anyone even doing these things in the first place? And you're like, man, it started with a cool dream of like, this thing that unifies people, especially now as theaters are dying, like you said, like everyone's like it's all more TikTok-y now than it, I mean, we use TikTok just as like a verb that means like on your phones rather than communally, but it just means something at some point.
At the risk of sounding like an old complaining millennial, like TikTok bums me out. Like that with the it can bring people together, but also it's like, yeah, you know, I can't go into this right now. Never mind. Preaching to the choir. But yeah, it seems like this Louis guy was actually a solid guy, and I love that. That he had a family and that he was like dedicated to that family and his art and everything. Yeah. That's really cool.
It's like that's something that we don't see often enough. And lastly, I'll say like the granddaughter was like, or the great granddaughter was like, the idea that his brother would kill him is insane. She's like, everything that I can look at through these records is like, they were all a big loving family, which, you know, admittedly, you don't know, like, you don't exactly know what's going on, but she was like, there doesn't seem to be any evidence that he was like, his brother would murder him for money or something. Right. You know, it's, so who knows? The mystery remains, but his contribution is important and he should be given credit. Anyway, I keep repeating
myself.
Thanks,
Louis LaPrance.
That's my top.
Thank you.
Thank you, Louis LaPrance. You are a king.
He's awesome. Thank you for that. It was really interesting. Like, of course, I always say this. I had no idea about any of this.
I didn't either.
Hey there. This is Adreed Kaveh, here to give that poor little guy host Kaveh a break. Hannah and I would like to ask you for help by going to nebula.tv/500opentabs and signing up for Nebula, where they have exclusives like Why Our TVs Wanted to Kill Us in 90s Movies by Tech Alter. Ever notice that 90s movies were obsessed with evil media? Shows plunging societies into ruin, video games that trap and torture players, and VHS tapes that kill anyone that watches them? What caused this sudden obsession? These kinds of wonderful video essays never cease to amaze me. I had to get a master's and go countless thousands of dollars into debt. But you kids now? You can get an annual subscription to Nebula that gives you the same insights for the cost of a carton of eggs, at the time of this recording, probably. You can find this video and dozens of other high production originals on Nebula, a video streaming platform built by and for creators. And along with videos and podcasts, you can now learn new skills in Nebula's fully produced classes. Go to nebula.tv/500opentabs and get 40% off an annual subscription. By signing up, you can support other creators like Maggie Mayfish, Princess Weeks, and many more. Remember, sign up at nebula.tv/500opentabs. Otherwise, Hannah and I will assume you hate us and will cry, much like host Kaveh is doing right now from not being allowed to talk for a whole 2 minutes.
Are you ready to get your are you ready to go into some weird abstract places? Because
we're in the arts, right? This is our this is what we love.
Yeah. Okay. I'll say this. I have gone down so many. It feels like my brain doesn't have core strength anymore. So it's like if my brain was forced to like start exercising and it like is suffering from it, like, oh, I can't do it. That's how it feels right now. My brain hasn't exercised in a long time, and now with abstract thought and all this, so I can't, like, I've gone in circles. I don't want to sound dramatic, but I'm a mess. So let's get into it.
Your brain just got up off the couch.
It got off of the couch and it's weak, and I'm exercising it against its will, and boot camp. Anyway, so before I get to my tab, I'm going to introduce. I'm going to be talking about the color GRU.
GRU?
GRU. So,
like Sergio Argonis's comic where he's like the savage that goes around killing people? The barbarian?
Sure. No, it's the color GRU.
Oh, you don't know GRU.
I don't.
Is it green blue?
Yes. So, okay, so years ago, I was trying to figure out why the word, I'm going to talk about a lot of about language and, of course, the languages I speak, which one of them is Welsh, about why the word for grass in Welsh translated to, had the word blue in it. It's like, why is it glass weft instead of green or weft. Whatever? And weft, that's like stock or like glass weft. Anyway.
Grass
weft. Glass. Glass weft.
Glass. Glass. Glass wet.
Yeah. Glass wet.
Wet and glass.
Wet glass. So years ago, I was like, why does this say, why is the word for, you know, and I got pulled into a Wikipedia page about blue-green distinction in language. And this was, I remember this okay. because I remember reading part of it and being like, nope, not today. And I closed that tab. This was like 4 years ago. So somehow I found my way back because when I was going through my tabs, I opened one that I'd opened a little while ago called No One Could Describe the Color Blue Until Modern Times from Business Insider, written by Kevin Loria. So okay. of course I was like, okay, this is kind of like Glass West or whatever. So of course I read the article and I enter a world I never knew existed, which is up until recently.
A world of blue.
A world of blue's not real. Okay. Just a second. So
breathe.
I go back to the Wikipedia about blue-green distinction, and it's just as mind-bending as I remember. And what I figured out was that up until relatively recently, there is no mention of the color blue in any language in ancient history, in any epic, in any story, in any writing, until I would say maybe 1,000 years ago.
Okay.
And I was like, well, why is that? And so I wasn't the first one to think this either. So the first person I found that thought about this, I mean, I'm sure it was way more people than just this dude, just this British dude, but they do, you know, as they like to do, take credit for it. So for you British people out there who remember anything from class and school or whatever, four-time Prime Minister of England, William Gladstone, in like the 1850s, before he was Prime Minister, he was reading the Odyssey by Homer, and he noticed something weird.
As one does,
just for fun.
Yeah.
He noticed that Homer describes the ocean as, quote, the wine dark sea. And he was like, why would he describe the ocean as wine dark? Like wine is purple or, you know, dark red.
Filled with blood, maybe?
Well, that's what this, he was like, maybe the Greek people just couldn't see the color blue, like an idiot. And he also kept reading and was like, wait a second, he's describing a lot of things weird. Like he kept describing sheep as being violet. And
is Homer like colorblind?
Well, that's what he wondered. Like, why is that? I mean, that's what I thought too. Like, oh, Homer must not be able to see like green, blue, or red, green, colorblind. And he came to the conclusion that maybe Greeks just couldn't see blue, or they were sort of colorblind, or they never needed to describe it, which that theory falls apart because the sky is blue.
Yeah.
But then a little later, another linguist, actually, Lazarus Geiger, he started studying this phenomenon too. And he realized,
that's a cool name.
I know, Lazarus Geiger.
It's a hell of a name.
He realized, Mr. Lazarus Geiger, he realized that this is the same across all cultures. Nobody had a colorful blue in the way that we see it today. There weren't descriptions or word for it in any old sagas the world over. So he also noticed there were no color words for orange or pink either until very recently. And after a bunch of people kept, you know, studying this, they started realizing that the things that were blue, it wasn't because they were colorblind or dumber than us or whatever. It was that they categorized blue as green. All these different researchers were like, okay, so it's pretty universal that back in the day, ancient languages didn't use blue to describe the sky or the sea or anything that's blue. They used the color green or something even weirder. And this is where my mind started falling apart. And I was like, I don't know how to understand this. I need to call somebody. And so I called my sister-in-law, Josie. And
Josie?
Josie.
You were
Josie
staying
fame.
Josie.
Yeah. She,
oh, my God,
oh my,
I love it.
I stayed so Josie this whole time. I was like, Josie, she's a linguist. She got a degree in linguistics, as did her sister, Carmen.
That's a very convenient family member to have around.
You have no idea. She's now our official linguistics expert, I've decided.
Of the podcast. All right.
Of the podcast.
We can shepherd these questions over to her every time.
She would love that. She told me that she would love that. Anyway. So I'm like, Josie, please explain blue and green to me in linguistics. And she was like, oh, yes, I love that you asked me this. And she knows all of it. And so I'm going to now try to describe the phenomenon of GRU. Here's how it helped me. So Josie was like, if you think about it in categories or terms, is what they call them, color categories. Every language has color categories. For example, English has 11. And you can kind of see them like families almost. Like the color category for green can include sage, olive, forest, etc. And our brain has these helpful buckets to put all those colors in. And to figure out what a color category is, you have to follow that line back and think, well, what is olive? Oh, olive's green. What's green? And if you have no answer to that, that means it's a category. So
gotcha.
English has 11. And then they're black, white, red, green, yellow, blue, brown, orange, pink, purple, and gray. This is true for most languages, which I looked up, including Persian and Welsh.
Oh.
Persian's a weird one, though, because they sometimes include silver and gold as colors, as color categories.
Classic stereotypical more... Persians. We got to talk about the silver and gold.
Wait, really? I love your take on it, too. But others, like the Burinmo language in Papua New Guinea, only have three names for colors. So they categorize their colors into three categories, and that is black, white, and red. And black can also be dark, and white can also be light. So they kind of see them in terms of, you know. And so it makes sense that Homer would describe the sea as wine dark, because back then...
Because he was a drunk.
He was a drunk, and everything looked like wine to him. Like when you're starving on a boat and your friend looks like a...
That's a little bit of wine. That's winey. He's a winer.
Just pukes over the edge of the ship.
And his mom catches it because she loves him.
Oh, she's... I like how we keep talking about catching vomit, and no one here knows what that is. We talked about that before we started this podcast today.
I was just telling Hannah a story before we recorded about how I was on a plane many years ago when I was a young man, and I saw a woman with her child, and on the flight, I was looking at the baby. He was funny. He was like laughing with me, and then he got sick and threw up, and the mother instinctually just threw out her hand and caught it like it was like she was an outfielder, like on a... Like it was like a baseball game. And it was like the craziest thing to me where I was like, damn, I was young. So I was like, damn, that's so cool. Moms will just catch vomit like it's nothing. And I
and
had
now
a lot
we've
of respect for that.
It.
And now we've talked about it on the show. That's why we keep referencing vomit getting caught.
And I'm really hoping that you're catching at least a little bit of this vomit that I'm bringing for you, because it's about to get a little more complicated. So back to the Papua New Guinea language. Burinmo. Back in the day, a bunch of white European scholars went to study the language, and they were like, they only have three colors. That doesn't make any sense. They must not be as evolved as us, because classic. But it absolutely wasn't that. So that was one set of researchers. And then fast forward to the future a little bit, and then you get these two linguists from Berkeley named Brent Berlin and Paul Kay. Now, these two guys were like, let's figure this out. Let's figure out why some languages only have three colors and some have 13, like Russian.
Yeah.
And so they not quizzed, but they surveyed a bunch of people from 20 different languages, and they discovered if a language had only three color terms, like that one from Papua New Guinea, they were always dark, black, white, and red. Always. No matter what. In any language, on anywhere on the earth. Those were always the colors that you start with. And then languages that had four, the fourth and fifth were always yellow or green in any order.
Okay.
Without exception. Yeah. Sixth was blue. And they found out as a rule that brown, purple, pink, orange, and gray will not emerge in a language until that language has made a distinction between green and blue. So it's almost like a gateway.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, so if you look back at old
it's like
Greek.
Evolution almost. It's
yes,
like color
it
identification has like a specific evolution in it. It's like it will not. It's interesting that it's a sciency thing almost, or it's like it will never until these colors are defined.
And
these other colors cannot be defined.
Right.
It's never
as a
happened
rule.
Any other way.
Nope.
That's weird.
And they started realizing that a lot of it depended on where they lived or what how they led their lives. And I mean, people theorize that language is what kind of guides us in everything, like on how we describe things, how we view the world, how we, you know. And so it would make sense.
It makes me think, too, it's like if red was the first one of the colors, it's like that's blood, right? That's probably like the first
that's
thing
exactly
that they're referencing
what
or
they
thinking
said.
Of.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's exactly what they said. And black and white. And so here's where I was like, Josie, what? What does black and white mean? How is that? How are those every other color? And she explained that it's not necessarily black and white. It's light and dark.
Light and dark. Yeah, I was going to say day and
dark,
night.
Yeah. Dark is blue and purple and green and like greens and things like that. And light is more like yellows and stuff like that. Yellows and some greens.
Yeah, they're dealing with like value basically more than they're dealing with like a specific color. Yeah,
exactly. And so they see it more as like
all they needed was just like an art school student who could have told them all this
crap,
idiots.
I think this is why it blew my mind so much, is because I couldn't
freshman
unlearn.
Color theory could have told these idiot scientists like that's what this all that they're doing, like dipshits.
No, but kind of seriously.
Listen to artists. We are
not
totally
dumb.
Useless. We have information sometimes.
Do I follow that color information by feeling alone? Yeah. Can I describe it? No.
Yeah.
But it doesn't mean I don't know it.
Yeah.
So I was like, so what does it mean? How would you distinguish between the sky and the ocean if they're both the same color of dark? Or sorry, if they're both the same... Oh my gosh, let me start that over.
Color of light, yeah.
For example, the sky is light. And the ocean is dark. And when you describe the ocean, you describe it as ocean dark. If you describe the forest, it's forest dark. So
okay,
it's like, does that make sense? Like it's like more of a description of the
value.
Well,
the qualifier is, but I'm saying so to say ocean dark versus forest dark, the qualifier of ocean or forest is the important thing because that's placing the context for what it is.
And it's less... It's less about the color and more about the thing, which
that's that's you're like it's ocean, dummy. Like who cares what the abstract color
is?
I'm telling
you
about this
is
the
ocean,
which
is which makes sense when you kind of like strip away all meaning
literally,
of everything.
Yeah. This is boxes of crayons. This is like ocean blue versus like forest blue. You know, Crayola understands this inherently.
And I took me stripping down everything I understood about like how I saw color. I spent last night just trying to sort a bunch of colors into these three categories to try to figure out what would have been in red, what would have been in all of that. And so some of the languages, this also was really fascinating that Josie was talking about, was that like when it comes to describing color, if a bird has blue feathers, that is not blue. That is bird
light.
Feather light.
Oh, I did get it. I literally say that as like a joke. Okay.
You're getting it, yeah. And so as colors emerge.
I'm fully on board with this, which might mean that I'm like.
Why are you grasping this so easily?
In my brain. I don't know, because I'm apparently as unevolved as like the people that the scientists thought that they were unevolved.
That's kind of interesting because I was going to bring up Farsi next. Because Josie explained this to me in terms of Welsh, which was really why I understood it.
I wonder if some of this has to do with speaking more than one language and just like having to switch back and forth and then like that becoming another way of communication where you're like, well, I don't know what the word for this is, but I can explain what this reference point is.
Yeah.
To say that like I can't say like cerulean blue, but it doesn't seem crazy to me that I would, if I'm trying to translate into Farsi or English, where it'd be like, oh, this is the color of the ocean blue as a describer.
Yeah.
I think that's part of why it doesn't seem crazy to me. That seems perfectly logical. It's just like there's always a reference point to reality. And then from there, there's like this offshoot of like what this value might be, right? Is that sort of, am I getting it?
Yes. Yes.
Okay.
What the heck, dude? Okay. Why does this come? Why? I feel insane. I feel like I've gone insane. Like, because my reference point is that the only true thing is that this is blue. And that's the main thing. So
let me ask you this. When did you learn Welsh? When did you learn Welsh?
In college.
Okay. I think this is totally a theory I'm pulling out of my ass.
Yeah.
But it's like from birth, I've had to communicate to multiple people who do not know how to speak the other language.
Oh.
Right? So at like different levels of proficiency. So it's like my grandmother did not speak English, and then I would have to try and explain something to her in Farsi that like I could say it in English correctly, but it was harder for me to translate. Even though my Farsi is very good, it's not like it wasn't like to the level that I wanted it to be. So I have to figure out these other ways to sort of bridge that gap and be like, this is a little qualifier that I can say here that would help maybe help describe this. I feel like if you're bilingual, if you're trying to communicate something, then that ends up being a driving factor of it. Maybe.
I think, well, I wouldn't be surprised at all if that were the case, especially if what I'm about to get into with Farsi is actually, so have you ever read Persian poetry? I don't know.
I've heard it. I can't read. I've listened to it.
Persian poetry is very abstract in description, which I think most poetry is. So let's talk about blue in Farsi. It was actually added really early to the language because of the discovery of indigo dyes. And they have found that the sooner that cultures started mixing dyes and pigments to blue, the sooner they added that color to their language because it opened up a whole new. So Persian, Egyptian, they were some of the first cultures to add blue to their vocabulary. And the way that Persian does it in its poetry, which was really fascinating, because before blue, they used green. They used green to describe the ocean and the sky. And a lot of these old poetry, they would... So the word for green is sabz, right? Sabz?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And they would put that in front of everything. So if they were describing the sky, so for example, they described it as the green ceiling. Sabz ashyana. Ashyane. Forgive me.
I would say sahf. But that's more contemporary. Sabz is green ceiling is what you would say?
Yeah.
Okay.
But it would be sabz dash whatever. And that's how they described anything that was blue. Okay. So the interesting thing about the Persian poetry is that you can watch the evolution through poetry over the years. And as they added indigo to their language or added other blue colors, you can start seeing how they describe. They would, instead of saying sabz whatever, green whatever, they would start replacing it with different new blue colors that they started not putting these blue colors in the green container because there were so many more colors of blue. They had to have their own category.
They're running out of uses for this.
Yes. And so the more blue there is, the more, you know, of a need. And it all kind of like hinged on dyes. Sorry, I got ahead of myself.
All I'm thinking of now is like, it's Bob's wife. Bob's wife. We should give her a name. That's not just a qualifier of being Bob's wife.
I've seen her more than once now, so maybe I should.
More than one time. Frank's wife, too. Do they have different names? That's weird.
That's actually a great way of seeing it. A sexist, but great way. Josie explained it as like a doctor, like you going to a doctor and being like, here are my symptoms. And the doctor's like, we call that lupus. But that doesn't necessarily mean it's lupus. That's what they categorize it as they know it. And as they learn more, then they'll be like, oh, that's actually this. It doesn't mean that it was never that. It just means that now it's called that. If that makes sense.
I'm 100% on everything you're saying. I totally get. And I don't know why
is it
intuitively
bothering
I completely
me?
Understand what you're saying.
Why does it bother me that this is so easy for you to get?
I think it's...
It's fine. I'm so glad. But like, if you could have seen me last night...
That's my totally unfounded, like unscientific theory, is that like you've never had to translate back and forth between people. So you have to like find these things that you like latch onto to try and be like, you know how like this is like this? It's like that because you don't know the word for it. So like I've just done that forever. Not because I was like trying to. It was just sort of
you had to.
Or if you like, when you travel abroad, you know, if you're like, oh, I have a dictionary that's trying to, you know, tell me what the word for this is. And you have to try and explain it to somebody like in, you know, Peru or something because your Spanish isn't that good. Like that kind of crap. Like, it would make sense that those kinds of things are like, it's frustrating too. You're like banging your head against the wall trying to come up with like, you don't know what this word is. And so you have to, it forces you to come up with these weird creative ways to explain something to somebody else.
Forces you to communicate, which is like on a small scale is exactly what we see languages all over the world doing over the last like 3,000 or 4,000 years is slowly learning to communicate for new things. And the part that's like wild to me is that like blue dye is honestly when most people started adding blue to their vocabulary, or at least distinguishing Weird. Between blue and green, and getting rid of gru, which is what linguists call this.
Which, by the way, did you see the text I sent you?
No.
I just texted you something very important.
Oh my gosh. It better be something cool.
That's gru.
Oh, no, I know. Okay. I know what this is. It's Dave's
that's
gru?
What I'm picturing in my head. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So the conclusion? No, there's no conclusion. I'm not done yet. I skipped to the end. Okay. Okay. So after Josie spoon fed this to me, I finally was able to understand that it's all just how you see it. And it's not that they couldn't see blue, because for some reason, everyone thinks that. I kept finding these articles that's like, did you know ancient people couldn't see blue? And it's like, wait, what? We had the same biology. So of course they
can. Yeah, that makes no sense. Yeah.
They just had a category. Blue was inside the green category, which kind of makes sense. And if you think about it now, orange is very new. It's a very new color, which is why it's named after the fruit. Because it was one of those things that they described the color as orange, as in the fruit. Mm-hmm. Kind of like that, like, bird wing blue.
Right, the reference point. Yeah.
Yeah, bird feather blue, orange, red, or whatever orange was under. It was under red. Which is also why, like, if you look at orange, if you really think about orange, it kind of doesn't, you can easily say, like, no, that's just red, or that's yellow, like dark yellow, or...
Yeah, there's enough close analogs
to it,
for sure.
Red. And and same with pink. Pink is a wild one. Yeah. They didn't have a word for pink until like the 1500s.
That makes sense.
Pink,
it's just red.
It was
that's
just
really
light red. Yeah, light red.
Yeah.
And pink. This here's a weird thing. I tried to figure out where the word pink came from, and nobody knows. It just happened.
It came from the Barbie movie. I thought is when it was.
Oh,
invented.
You're right. Back in 1550. Yeah. Greta Gerwig, medieval
ahead
peasant.
Of her time.
That derailed me. Oh, ooh. So yeah, pink is new, and I feel like a crazy person, like on the sidewalk being like, blue's not real, and everyone's like, call the police, she's bothering us.
She's screaming about blue again.
It's old blue Hannah.
She blew my mind.
I'm afraid I blew myself. What does Tobias say?
he said some wonderful things.
Such a good show. So a fun little thing about Russian. Russian is a language that has 13 color categories. Two of those being dark blue and light blue. So they early on distinguished like blue, dark blue and light blue are different colors in Russian. And they, I don't know why. Wish I could tell you.
Did you say which one had the most? Is it Russian?
So from what I can see, it's Russian.
Okay.
And then there's the argument that Persian has more because some cultures consider matte and metallic and shiny as different colors. So,
okay.
Which I couldn't wrap my head around, so I gave up. So I'm not going to go into that.
Why was it hard for you? It's just like saying it's just a different color. That's all. If it's assigned to like one, but again, don't think about it as like an abstract color. Think about the thing that it's assigned to.
Right,
so like,
right.
Like ruby, right? Or whatever.
Yeah.
Or like some, think of a stone. If a stone is one specific color that's sparkly, right? You just that's the color is ruby. And then if you're like out in nature and then you are out somewhere where there's clothes and it's got like sparkly red, you'll be like, oh, it's like that ruby color. It like reminds me of the rock, right? And so that's the qualifier for the sparkly thing. Does that make sense?
Yes. Thank you.
Literally all you have to do is you have to just assign it to a specific tangible thing. That's it. That's the only secret here. Every color is referenced back to a specific item. Just think about it like that.
Right. Okay. No, you're right. Like, which I
just
feel like
you said, like with orange.
It's been floating. It's all floating in my head. And a lot of it hasn't been connected to each other. And it's funny because like I've been going crazy over this. Like, why is it so hard for me? And I do think you have a point. Like, I'm monolinguist. I was monolingual
monolingual,
up until I was 18. And fascinating. So
to be clear, it's like I don't think people who speak one language wouldn't know I'm saying that. Like, I think that's probably why I can understand it faster.
That you picked up on it
faster.
Because
the people who have these languages that you're talking about that only have like three colors, for example, they're not necessarily bilingual. But the idea that like, oh, this language functions completely differently than this language is like being bilingual to me already is like, okay, I intuitively understand that just because of circumstances of how I was raised.
Languages aren't just like, oh, I can't understand. They describe things differently. They're structured differently, and they're structured very similar to the culture that they are from and the needs of that culture, which it's why you get things you can't translate like to other languages. Like, I you know what I think my problem was is that I was trying to make it deep, trying to figure out why, when really it is just a sign, like the buckets in your head where it's like, this is here, this is here. And for
it's really interesting.
Blue and green were the same bucket. Cool. I'm not. It just blew my mind, and it's like melting me. So a fun little thing, like I started thinking about stuff in Welsh, where the like when I first started reading about Glaswellt, which is the word for grass, and it means blue,
right?
Blue field or something, and I found out that glass in Irish is green. And so they had come from the same root word that, and what glass means in Welsh is the, it just translates to color of the sea. So again, it's the item that it is the color of, where this is sea blue, and it won out over the other grues.
Kill me.
So Glaswellt, still really quick. Welsh is a little different because that's what they assigned to blue. And when the Roman invasion happened, they brought a word for green. And the Welsh chose that word for green. Instead of adding blue to their language, they just took a word they already had and were like, this is blue now, and this new thing is green, which I thought was really interesting. And
interesting, yeah.
Another fun thing, I realized that like the word for brown sugar in Welsh is siwgr coch, which just means red sugar. Because back in the day, coch, we've gone over this.
Coch.
It means something horrible in Farsi.
Goch. Goch with a G, but not koch.
Okay. Sugar koch. Koch, yeah. And
shikarik koch, which would be
tell me.
Shitty sugar in Farsi.
Beautiful.
Shikarik koch.
Should we name this episode Shitty Sugar?
TBD.
And I thought that was interesting because it's like, oh yeah, because back in the day, red covered brown and like certain grays and certain oranges and anyway, that's all.
I love it.
I am so glad that you grasped this because.
Shut
up. I'm fine. I'm good. Nothing's real. It's all based on what we call it, you know?
I like to think of is like, what was the first, and this is going to make my own brain explode. So it's like, how do you, the first person to ever see blood, if they're trying to explain to the other person, they're like, this thing is a different, what's a color? How do you explain that this thing looks differently from that? And they're like, oh, I don't know. It's like liquid, like you like water. Yeah, it's, but like not water.
It's like ocean dark, but it's not.
Yeah.
This is ocean dark, but it's different.
But it's no, because like when you discover the first, because you said that's always black, white, which you said is light and dark, and then red. So really,
and then red's
the only, it's so technically you could say like red's the real first like color.
Yes.
Right?
And because.
So it's kind of funny to be like, how do you describe what that is when you don't have a language for any of it?
You don't. I don't know. It's like body liquid that means death.
I just feel like, but I'm saying that's what's so interesting about red being the first color. I feel like blood is probably always the reference point.
Yes. It
always goes back to blood.
Because that's like the first thing we understand. And same with fire, obviously. And if you think about, like Josie was saying, this one more thing. Josie was saying that the reason red comes first is because it looks different than the other colors. If you look at it next to everything else, it's like, oh,
yeah,
red. Like that is a very strong, almost as strong as black and white. And that makes sense.
And as you said, it's the associations with death and harm. Like red is an emotional color in that way.
Mm-hmm. And it's ancient.
Inherently. It's ancient. It's been around as long as literally anything living.
That's my tab.
Except for plants, obviously. That's awesome. That was fun stuff. You made it through. Good job.
I did. I got in my head about it, and I spit it all out. I vomited, and I hope you caught some in your hands, like a real mother.
I caught so much in my hands. My hands are just
It seems
covered.
Like you caught all of it green. In your hands. because at this point, my vomit is slipping through my fingers. Like, that's how I caught it. I caught it, and I was like, no more puke.
As we go to... No, it made me think of another thing, which is as we go to close our tabs, should our sound effect just be vomit?
Yeah, dude.
Just totally unrelated to either of our tabs. Maybe like a camera running in the background, like filming someone vomiting. Maybe that's too much, but just and then we close the tabs.
I like that. I like just vomit. That's disgusting.
Okay, vomit it is.
Okay.
You want to go ahead and do the countdown?
Yeah. Good riddance. Yes. Okay. I have got to find it, of course. Got to go through this little thing where I find it.
In the meantime, I'll just keep making dry heaving noises.
Okay, I'll get you that. I found it.
We're about to. Okay.
Okay, ready? 3, 2, 1, close it. Take that behind the barn, shoot it in the head, put it out of its misery. I wasn't going to talk about death, dude. That was my promise to someone in the Discord.
Why would you promise that?
Because I feel like it was I had something to prove, and I don't know, man. But I just talked about it.
I don't think I even made one 9/11 joke this whole time, man.
I'm proud of you.
This episode's a huge disappointment.
You know who else is a huge disappointment? Is both of us.
Both of us, yeah.
Well, yeah, that was wild.
That was good. Okay, moving on to listener emails. You ready for this? Okay.
Yeah.
So our first email is from Sarah, who I can only assume is not my wife because it doesn't seem to be Sarah's email address. But if she started a separate email address just to submit this, I'm going
to
ask her about
it later.
Just to
troll
never
you.
Never in a million years would happen. Yeah. Could not be bothered to write into this show to make fun of me. She's like, I have other stuff to do. Bye. Anyway, dear 500 open tabs, parentheses, Kava and Hannah, the story about people living in airports unlocked a core memory for me. I suddenly vaguely remembered that as a kid, there was a book that was read to us at school about a boy and his dad who lived in an airport. At first, I thought, surely I'm remembering this wrong. So I did a Google search and nope, there is definitely a kid's book about living in the airport. As I continued listening to the episode, I assumed it would be brought up, but again, no dice. So I'm sending this link to you for your entertainment. I hope you find it as amusing as I did. Cheers, Sarah. P.S. I love the podcast.
Thanks, Sarah.
Thank you, Sarah. The name of the book is Fly Away Home by Eve Bunting.
Wait, I've heard of this book.
Have you heard of this?
Yeah.
I'm going to send you the...
I haven't read it.
I don't remember it, but maybe you can look at the cover. I don't remember this, so it did not come across my desk or library at any home. It's illustrated by Ronald Himmler. Sorry, the image is small.
I hope it's not Himmler.
Not that Himmler.
You know, I think this was on the... I've seen this before. You know those days where... I think I saw someone reading this on one of those days where we could all just sit in the classroom and read a book. You remember those days?
Yeah, it seems... the style of it and the cover and like the blue border
very
90s children's book to me.
Book fair.
So I looked it up on Goodreads. Somebody just wrote like a quick little summary that just says this book deals with the issue of homelessness. It's told through the eyes of a boy named Andrew. Andrew is being raised by his father and they live together in an airport. Trying to remain unnoticed, Andrew tells the reader about his daily life and how it's both similar and different than that of a child with a home. He leaves us with hope that someday he, like the trapped bird in the window, can flee his current living situation and return home. Sounds pretty heavy.
Oh, that does sound heavy. I'd read it.
It seems like it's got a lot of reviews and people liked it or people remembered it. I'd never read it. I'd never seen it. The illustrations look cool, though.
So I feel like, a movie? I feel like it was a movie.
Yeah, it was called The Terminal.
Oh, no, it was a movie.
Up in that episode. Oh, it was.
It's The Terminal. Yeah, no, it was a movie. I think that's... Who's in it?
Wasn't Fly Away Home the Elijah Wood movie?
That's why I know it. That's why I know it, dude. Hold on. Give me a second. I've opened a new memory.
No. Not Elijah Wood. Anna Paquin with the ducks.
Yeah, it's the duck movie.
I'm thinking of Radio Flyer. Yeah. Sorry. I'm
Radio
just
Flyer
all
is
my
the
Alzheimer's
one.
Is coming back at once. Yes.
Coming back at once.
Not ducks. Like I guess it's... geese. Is it geese?
Yeah,
yeah, geese.
It's geese. Canada
gooses.
Geese.
Silly
I think
gooses.
I was thinking of the movie.
It is the same title. You're not wrong.
Yeah. Anyway.
By the way, it is Ronald Himmler. I don't know if he's related to that
Himmler.
I assume not.
Oh, it is Himmler?
It's H-I-M-L-E-R, Ronald.
Oh, that's different Himmler.
It's an unfortunate last name to have. But anyway,
yeah.
Go check out Fly Away Home. See if you guys remember it. Thank you to Sarah for the email.
Yeah. Okay, so mine is a little bit long, but who cares? Okay, email number two is from Rebecca, and she does not say where they're from. Hello, Kaveh and Hannah. This paper has been on my to-read list for years, and this pod reminded me to finally read it. Hey.
All right.
And she linked a PDF to this like academic paper. And it says, this paper was published in the Journal of Applied Animal Behavior Sciences in 2016 and is from the Norwegian Whoa. University of Life Science. Smart people stuff. So this is all about horses. I thought that was just fun because we just talked about...
Oh my God, Nicola.
Yeah. And also the horse, the movie horse thing you talked about. So there's a couple horses in here. I can't now put words together, you know? I'm a husk of me. I'm no brain no, you know? Meet at later bar sometime day or night. What does he say?
Is
Meet
it
at later bar sometime, yeah. Day or night sometime or something. Yeah. Okay. I got very sidetracked. All right. I'm gonna put on the face of a functional person. Cosplay. Let's do this. Cosplay.
I like how you're the one who's like, let's just go long today, whatever. I can see the whole this thing.
No, look, I got out all the color stuff and now I'm nothing. Okay, back to the horses. It's common for horse owners to put winter jackets on their horses, and it's highly debated on whether this practice is actually beneficial to horses or if it instead hinders their natural ability to keep warm. The researchers thought the best way to answer this question was to ask the horses themselves.
Naturally.
The researchers trained the horses to associate three different symbols written on a poster board. Researchers are insane.
That was going to be like, the researchers trained the horses to respond to follow-up emails asking them what their thoughts were about their jackets, and on a scale of 1 to 10, and if they have further comments to type it in so they could...
Just circling back to remind you of this email, horse. Can you just get back to us on this?
Yeah.
That means no. The researchers... Okay, I'm going to make it through this email. The researchers trained... Yeah, they got the three different symbols written on the poster board. One, take the jacket off. Two, put the jacket on. Or three, no change. The horses would then tap the specific symbol to indicate their handlers when they asked if they wanted their jackets on or off. To make sure the horses weren't just randomly tapping and actually understood what the symbols meant, they tested the horses under different conditions. Putting the horses outside in jackets on warm, sunny days, all the horses in the study pressed the symbol to remove the jacket. Conversely, on the test day where it was cold, 15 degrees, this is all Fahrenheit, by the way, and windy, the horses all asked to put their jackets back on, or the no change symbol if they were already wearing the jacket. Overall, they found that the horses could rationalize the effects of the jacket and understand the long-term consequences of wearing one. The horses' answers also fell on a spectrum, some asking for their jackets on, while others asked to keep it off in the same weather. Reflecting the horse's cold tolerance varies by individual, same as humans.
All I'm thinking is, the horse that didn't want it on is like, I would not be caught dead in that jacket.
That is hideous.
What kind of horse jackets do they make? Are they like down jackets? Are they like peacoats? Or like what? I think this is like a huge factor that they're not taking into consideration of their experiment. Yeah.
Very cool to have a published study showing how smart horses are, as long as you take the time to listen. Best, Rebecca. P.S. My other favorite horse study is that they can recognize their faces in mirrors and understand when a photo of them has been photoshopped, But that's for another day.
Like when they're photoshopped? Horses are going to be trained to like distinguish between like deep fakes and real videos from now on.
Barack Obama did not call for a second January 6th. No, Boomer on Facebook. It's misinformation.
This photo has been edited. Yeah. Well, and then I should have said this at the beginning, but the email was titled "Horses Can Understand the Weather" or something along those lines.
I like it better not knowing what the email is titled.
Then cut that part.
As you were telling me the story where I'm just like, what?
What are we talking about?
They can see themselves in the mirror and they recognize, and they like jackets, which the natural extrapolation is that horses have thoughts about jackets. What, and they can see how they look when they're wearing a jacket.
We
need to figure out what jackets are horses' favorite style of jackets, or
combine
the most stylish.
The studies where they're looking
exactly.
in the mirror and
that's
saying,
what we need to figure
that's
out.
Not the jacket I want. Also, I want to know if they're okay with us riding them. I've always wondered that.
Riding? No, I think horses are pretty good about, like, they will tell you if they don't want you to ride
true.
Them.
They'll, like, kill you. They'll buck you off and
stomp
on you.
Yeah, basically. Yeah. I think horses are pretty bro. They're cool that way.
Bro. I remember when I was little, we used to go hiking up the canyon by my house, and people would take their horses up there. And I remember trying to go up to a horse and pet its tail, and my dad was like, no, and, like, saved my life. Because if you touch them when they're in the back of them, they'll kick and, like, kick you in the face.
Oh, yeah, that's dangerous. Anyway, horse jackets, totally going to be a thing. We're going to design them. We're going to start a line. We're going to have horse jacket fashion shows where they're going to come down the, you know, the runway.
Yeah. We're going to have some of the jackets be blue and some of them be green and see if they consider them the same color.
Exactly. And they're going to be like, this is manure green and this is like regular green.
And this is sky green.
And this is sky green. We're going to call them Jokic jackets. Jokic jackets. I don't know, something around. We're workshopping that a little bit. But something with the J, I think that could work.
Yeah.
Jokits, like jackets and Jokic combined.
Yes. Yes. Just got really excited. Jokits.
Horse jacket.
I'm barely here.
And just in the nick of time, everybody, thank you for your emails. Please send us emails. We want more emails. Please, we can never, ever get enough. We need more. If you've already done it, just do it again. We don't care. We're just
be
avoiding
like Nico
doing
and
our
Riverside.
Own tabs. Yeah, Nico, shout out.
Always writing some good ones.
You can send an email to 500opentabs@gmail.com. That's 500opentabs@gmail.com. Let us know.
You can also follow us. Sorry, I jumped on you.
That's okay. That's the next part. But you can also follow us, But just to finish the thought, 500opentabs@gmail.com. Submit your tabs. Let us know what you learned or what was funny about it. Tell us where you're from. Because that's what we like to hear. And
we
also
want to
don't
dox
forget to include
you.
The link.
I didn't mean
we
to say that.
We do not want to dox you.
I don't want to dox anybody. It came out of my mouth like vomit.
It's about that time. Why don't you vomit out our social media posts and all that?
Yeah. 500 open tabs on Instagram, the number. Same with Twitter, X, and YouTube. YouTube is important. We post videos that's where you can see all the shorts and the fun everything. And then
full video episodes on YouTube. Yeah. If you guys have been listening to this podcast and you didn't know, you can see our beautiful faces on YouTube.
And where can they follow you?
I'm at Kavitarian on Twitter, which I barely go on, and at PermaFriends on Instagram. Of course. You should also tell us where to find
you. At Hannah Hillam on most things. Mostly Instagram.
On most things.
Yeah. Go like my posts.
And lastly, go like her posts.
Please laugh. What did Jeb Bush say? Please clap.
Please clap.
Please clap.
Tell your friends about the show. Follow the sponsor links. That's the stuff that helps us out. Ever now.
If this episode reminded you of anybody, any linguists, any film people, send it to them.
Any Josies. Yeah, please share this podcast.
Yeah.
Yeah, we're at that we're at that stage right now where we're trying to grow as much as we can, and it's going to be up to you guys, the listeners, to help spread the word. Because when we're like, hey, listen to our podcast, it's not as cool as when your friend tells you, I think. I think actually most of the podcasts that I have ever gotten into have been because a friend recommended them to me.
Word of mouth, yeah.
Yeah, so if you can, if you feel so inclined, I should say, if you don't want to recommend it, then don't ruin your friendship credits by recommending them a podcast that sucks.
Look, I don't care about any of this.
Anyway, that's a sign for us to wrap it up. Thank you, everybody, for listening. Please keep it Josie. We'll see you at the next one, so on and so forth, et cetera, et cetera.
Okay, thanks. Yep.
Yeah, bye.
Bye.